Hello again, this is part two of the anxiety episode. I'm going to get straight into it because I only realised during the end of the last of part one that I was going to start doing these in 30 minute episodes, because when I've done them, I did that hour long episode and I had a right fanny on trying to get that uploaded, I tell you. So yeah, getting back on, straight back into things, because apparently I've got a lot to say. I was worried I wouldn't have anything to say today because of, as I mentioned earlier, been suffering from a lot of anxiety these past few weeks, and I didn't know exactly what I was going to say, how I was going to say it, or what I would talk about. But yeah, I've been feeling useless a lot, very, very anxious. I've recently, I was on medication for about five, almost 6 years. I was stuck on escitalopram and subsequently citalopram, which for those of you who are not versed in the wonderful world of medicine and prescription drugs, they are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Basically, there's during depressive episodes, your serotonin levels fall. You know, your enjoyment levels, and these just give them. Speaking in very what's layman terms here, they just give you a boost of serotonin to get you back on an even keel. So I was prescribed them, like I say, almost 6 years back, and I've been taking them regularly ever since. Now, I went to my GP about, 3 months ago. And it was a new GP. I've experienced a lot of problems with primary care, the gatekeepers that are our general practitioners in the past. And having studied health and social care, as I think I've touched upon in previous episodes, I understand why. There are difficulties in that area of the NHS. It's self-explanatory, really. You know, with budgets, time constraints, all manner of other things that are off topic. So we'll get away from that right now. But basically, I've had trouble with getting through to these people. Another area where communication has been very difficult for me, and has just engendered or fostered this sense of isolation. You know, people who are there to as kind of the go-to for these things, when you feel like you can't go anywhere else, like to family or friends, you go to these people. And I've had some very, very debilitating experiences with them. But this one I went to the other month, she was fantastic, very attentive, took her time, knew her shit for a change. God knows the amount of times I've gone to a GP. I mean, I'll get into this now. I went to a GP following an almost successful suicide attempt, and I went back to consider my options, because I tried to swallow, I stockpiled a few months worth of these tablets I'm talking about, and swallowed them with a lot of paracetamol and a lot of rum. Just had a text off Roy there. Hi Roy. Swallowed a liter bottle of rum and a liter bottle of vodka. That happened. Thank fuck I came through that. But when I got back on my feet after a while, I went back to the doctor. Said, you know, what am I doing here? I'm on these pills which were prescribed for manic depression and for social anxiety. And he asked he just sat there glum and said, what are you on about? I mean, what are you taking? What have you been taking? And I was gobsmacked, to say the least. And I said, right, well, I've been on them. At that point, I've been on them maybe 3 years. And I said I originally was referred to a therapist via Mind in Gateshead, where I did an intensive course of therapy there, which I didn't find helpful because it was a 6-week course. And, you know, the exit route for that is, it's just ridiculously hard. You know, you get in, you finally get through. You have to jump through all this bureaucracy and all these, you almost have to prove that you require help. You have to prove that you are eligible for. But when, again, that's another problem with the NHS that comes down from the government, which we're not going to get into here. This isn't the time for that. But the issue here is that I told them all this. At that point, I think I'd also been to the trauma unit for several weeks, seeing a great psychiatrist there. Not ashamed to say that, by the way. A lot of people still joke about the Tranwell unit in conversation. when talking about, you know, madness, mad people, or, you know, sad cases or whatever. I went there for quite a long time and found it very helpful, and I'm not ashamed to say that. So anyway, back to this doctor. I'm telling him, I'm basically giving him a potted account of the history of my mental health treatment, and he had fucking no clue what I was talking about. So I suggested rather casually that he press a fucking button on his fucking computer and perhaps do a bit of reading on me, and he would see it all there, plain as day. But he wasn't really interested in that. So he asked about what had just been happening, and I was cracking, I was bursting into tears at this point, because I was but sort of a week out of hospital. And I said, you know, what do you mean? What can you actually mean? I've just come, I'm just recovering from a suicide attempt. I was in the QE. I've met with the crisis team. I've been interviewed by them. You know, they told me they were writing a letter to you, which I give the thumbs up for. It should all be here. Of course it should be. This is a very vulnerable, fragile moment for me, and I'm basically being told nobody's paying attention. Just try and imagine the level of... I guess a lot of people can't. When you're in that position, when you're that low, and then you come out of it, and you're just trying to tie up the practical loose ends, the things like, oh, right, I'm back. I've got to get on with things now. What do we do? And my issue was, what do I do about my medication? Because obviously I might not be able to I might not be able to collect it anymore, because it might be too dangerous, given that I've stockpiled it and tried to kill myself using it. And he had no earthly idea that that's what I was getting at. And moreover, I'll never ever, as long as I live and breathe, I'll never forget what he said to me. And this is a doctor, a man of science, said to me after I told him I tried to kill myself. He looked up at me in a very, this is pretty hard. He looked up at me and he was just entirely in disbelief, you know, that I'd do such a thing. And he said, oh, you mustn't do that. You know, there's only God has rule there. You can't kill yourself. At which point, in the story I tell myself about that moment, I got up and gave him the RKO. But in reality, I just sat there and took it and cried. So I guess my advice to you, if you ever seek, if you do, and you should seek help, if you're ever that low, probably take somebody with you. If you are completely alone though, and despairing, and feeling like you can't do that, then just be aware that this might actually happen. And there's no real planning you can do for that, but if you're aware of it, at least maybe it won't be so painful if it does happen to you. It will be painful, but just knowing that it's a possibility will steel you against it somewhat. But that was one of the worst moments of my entire life, I would say. So yeah, these tablets, anyway, it was established that I should go back on them. With little or no conversation or thought, I mean, he didn't even go into, well, we're going to have to sort of dole them out in increments, by degrees, because you can't be trusted, or not so much that you can't be, you know, you shouldn't really say that to somebody who's just trying to kill himself, but knowing him, he probably would have had, you know, none of the awareness to actually say you can't be trusted. And what he should have said, if he was going to say that, is, you know, it's too dangerous for you to receive the drugs directly. All he did was write us another prescription and hand it to me, you know, 7 days or so after I tried to kill myself on them. So just, this thing, these things happen, they go on, they actually happen. It's really, it's horrific, but they do happen. So to get back on track, I was back on the citalopram for another, you know, from that moment up until about 2 months back. The other problems I've had is GPs trying to get me moved off those onto different tablets for, and they've been blatant about it, they've made no bones about it, for cost-saving measures. And I've had to really, you have to learn to put your foot down, and especially with somebody like me who's quite a passive person, who, anything for a quiet life, you know, you're quite vitriolic in private when I'm espousing my thoughts here over this, but get me, you know, a lot of the time I feel like a spineless twerp, because I'm not like that a lot of the time in person, but I have had to learn to be through these things, because I've had to put my foot down and, you know, say, I don't give a fuck how much money it saves, I'm only interested in my health, so I just want the tablets that are right for me. And you've got to, if you're in this position ever, you've got to be strong, and it's difficult when you are, by virtue of the fact of being in that position, you're perhaps not necessarily weak. I'm not saying you're a weak person by nature, maybe you are, I find that I feel that I am, but just weak, you're in a weak position at that point in time, hence why you're going to these people who should be there to help and buttress you and reassure you, and you have to find some strength somehow not to be walked all over. So, you know, please, if you're ever there, if you ever find yourself there, just know that that does happen, and it can happen. And try, and even though it's in like such a point of weakness, just try to find the resolve to stand up for yourself. Because it's only for, you know, that split second that you have to find that. Even if you just fake it, just try your best. So these tablets are this GP, this lovely GP who I've just now started working with. Sorry, I'm just reading text again. Alright, I'm only 11 minutes in, that's cool. This GP was stunned when I said, so what can I do for you today? And I can't even remember what the appointment was about. I think I had an issue. I was training for the Great North Run, and I'd started pissing blood, which I know is quite vulgar, but it's the truth. Damn it. And now, I mean, speaking of anxiety, have you seen those commercials over here in the UK now about peeing your blood? Might be cancer, you know, not to scare you out. So that's set us off a bit anxiety-wise lately. So I was getting that checked out, and then we're talking about medication. She was like, what are you on? I told her, and she went, oh, so how long have you been on those? And when I told her it was nigh on 6 years, she almost fell off her seat, off her ergonomic chair. And she said to me, you know, these are used for depressive episodes only. And I went, sweetheart, it's not so much an episode as a feature-length fucking film. Like, I guess for a long time I did take them sort of pliantly without questioning them too much. And I think it's important, if you are prescribed drugs, do your homework, and make sure that you're not just passively ingesting, because it's your body at the end of the day. I remember when I did try to swallow boxes of them, I was really struck by a doctor saying, have you ever tried to harm yourself before this? And because I didn't class this as self-harm, but Christ, it was the ultimate self-harm. And the damage I did to my kidney specifically is something that I really regret. So, yeah, just... I mean, it's not to be paranoid, maybe you're not an idiot like me, but I didn't really question these things for a lot of years, and it wasn't until more recent memory that I actually realised I've got the World Wide Web here where I can find information on these things. If the doctors aren't going to help, then just there are means to do it yourself. So, yeah, she explained to me that people usually prescribe these drugs for about 6 months maximum, so that you can get back on an even, so you can plateau again and then get back to life, back to reality. And what I was doing was rather ridiculous, it seems, and she couldn't believe that this had not been broached before by her colleagues or whatever, and subsequently I couldn't. I thought, well, you know, if that's how you feel, I'm with you there, like. So it was suggested that we would try to wean them down gradually, piecemeal, and I said, you know, I have me reservation. I got a serious reservation, as Tony Barron might say, of Barron's Nightclub. And you know, she listened. She listened and heard me out about my my reticence to do that, because obviously I've become dependent on these drugs for a long time, because when I've experimented before, I've tried to come off them on my own, and that was just another stupid thing I've done in my life that I can only hold my hands up to. Never do that. If you're on medication for these things, please don't just try and cold turkey it. Like, just get, it's simple. You've got the number of your practitioner on the phone. Give them a call and arrange an appointment. You'll probably get one pretty quick, and then go over this. Don't just impose this, you know, don't go down the self-imposed weaning off of medication, because I was ill through it and my anxiety spiked, went through the roof. So I told her about that and said, you know, I've come off it before, all right, under stupid circumstances, but my anxiety was chronic then. And she, you know, she said, we're going to do this in stages, and when you come off, we can review it. So I've been doing that lately, over the last couple of months, and to the point where now I haven't popped any of this these anxiety pills for maybe a month now, and it is a very difficult adjustment. Everything's, you're almost stumbling through things. There's like a haze hangs over you, and you've got this kind of, not a complete dizziness, like a drunk, you know, it's not a stupor or anything, it's just like a fog that you're feeling around in the dark some days, where you feel displaced and out of body, and looking down on yourself, or like, you know, I don't really need whiskey now, because I've just, basically all you need to do is come off medication and you'll have the same response. It's fucking, it's bizarre. So I've been going through that. I've been working very, very long hours, and then the pressures that go into that. I've had some problems with colleagues, both professionally and personally. I've got some huge news in my private life that I haven't really revealed to, I've only revealed to a very small group of people, but that's all happening. And then they all feed in, and it's just, I think the following episode, the episode after this, I want to do about grief, because it relates directly into what I'm feeling right now, and into the anxiety. Like the other day, I was just driving the car on a regular trip, maybe it's to work, and I found myself, it's this time of year, I mean, it was this time last year that my mother was really starting to degenerate. She died early December, so it was, you know, this autumnal weather, and the all the leaves are brown and the sky is grey. And I was driving the car, and I was wearing exactly the same thing as I was, you know, the same outfit I was wearing last year. I just picked up this big military parka for the autumn and coming winter, and I was wearing that, and I felt like I'd been transported back to that moment. And a song came on a playlist by Midlake, called Go Home, I think it's called, and I remember I used to listen to that album, The Trials of Van Occupantha, and that song a lot when I was driving up and down to the hospital in Leeds from Newcastle to see to my mother when she was dying of pancreatic cancer. So I broke down, I was just driving along just crying, really guttural, really, you know, that one where it's like somebody's put on an iron glove and just fucking hoofed you right in the just the stomach, you know, and had to pull over. And it's been like that for, I don't want to talk too much about it, because I'll not have anything to talk about when I do come to the grief episode. But that's just to give you an idea of the anxiety lately. It's all born of all that. But sometimes you don't even know. It's a cycle, and it's the cyclical nature is anxiety can just arrive, and for me it's usually first thing in the morning. As soon as I open my eyes from this beautiful sleep, bang, there it is. It's like acupuncture all over. Just this horrible attack on everything. You know, shit, what are you going to do? What are you going to do today? How are you going to justify your existence today? You've got this to do, you've got that to do. You know, you're making lists in your head, these huge lists of things you need to do. And you're immediately defeated by the enormity of that. You just want to pull the covers over your head, and then it's just in the fucking, right in the pit, in the recesses, like the deepest, darkest well of your insides, is this thing chewing you, you know, you can feel it. And in that moment, I just think, oh, I just want to fall back asleep. I'd give anything just to sleep right now. So it's an escape, if anything. And then it breeds, it's self-perpetuating, because then you feel anxious about lying there, not doing anything, not seeing to these things that so desperately need to be seen to. And then the panic rises and rises and rises, and then, you know, you just switch off, you don't want to speak to anyone. And then the ancillary things are people, friends and so forth, say, oh, you never get in touch, you never do this, you're such a shit friend. But, and that, you know, that's because you're anxious, you just want to lie in bed, you want to go to sleep, you've got no energy left to attack life anymore, you just want to submit, tap out. But then when they say that, it feeds into more anxiety about, oh God, I'm a shit friend, I'm a bad person, oh. And then things like, it gets misconstrued as laziness. Oh, you know, you stayed in bed all that day and worried too much about what people think of this thing that you just can't explain. You know, the inexplicable. Back there again, eh? So it's a pretty rough... pretty rough ride, the whole thing. Mine goes into, you know, you wake up first thing in the morning, like I say, and it's an assault. But you have to drag yourself through it in some cases, especially if you work. Or you've got things that absolutely have to be done. You've got to show up, you've got to show your face at least. And it just worsens. It can alleviate through the day. I had a very serious bout about 3 or 4 days back. And then I took myself to work and realised when I had a specific problem there that was causing me anxiety. And I just faced it head on. I just thought, right, fuck this. I'm not going to suffer alone through this thing. There's something practical I can do about this. And I found it in me. I found the fortitude, I guess, to do that. But sometimes that... And it's all right. It's absolutely fine that sometimes you just can't do that. You can't summon that kind of strength. It's debilitating, it really is, and my heart goes out to anyone out there who might listen to this who experiences that. But you've just got to ride through it. But there's nothing else. For all my years of experience and personally and in a professional context, I work with this type of thing as well. The best thing I can really say is you've just got to have the perspective, you know, you've got to give that fair appraisal of the situation, whereby, yeah, it's shit now, things are bad, but get the blinkers off and project ahead. Just think, what happened last time I was here, I somehow got past it and got to this point again. Yeah, I'm here again, but there was that in between, and you need to find the room to get to that in between. And the way I do that is just to say, I've got through it many times before, I'll get through it again. It's come to me, it's come around many times before, it'll come around again, but it will go away again. And those moments in between, that's what we need to find, and that's what we will find. We always will. And when the anxiety drops on us, when the black dog visits, I mean, you can roll your sleeves up and give it a fucking good go. And what I am saying is, it's fine if you haven't got it in you at that point in time to do that. That's fine. But try to just pat it on the head. You know, stroke it, placate it any way you can, and just accept it, that it's going to be there. It might be there for months, it might be there for a year, it might be there for 2 years, maybe longer. It might be there for a couple of days, it might be one afternoon. But just get used to it, get comfortable with it, and understand that you have to regulate it, you have to manage, but it's in your power to do so. You can do it, and you can move through it. You just have to ride it out, and... it's no comfort at all to know that you're not the only one. Well, it isn't for me anyway. To be honest, it probably unnerves me more than anything else when people say that, because I think depressives like to think they are alone in these things. That's part of the romance of it. Which is, again, it's such a quandary that the rug is pulled from under your feet so many times because of the complication is in the contradictions of the whole thing. You know, you don't want to be alone, but you do. You don't want to be miserable, but fuck, you really do. I want to be, like, leave me with this misery, this is great. I've even had days where I've been feeling great, you know, I'm listening to Hall & Oates and fucking Tapping Me Toe and God, everything's falling into place. And like Carrie Fisher said before, like, people are saving parking spaces just for you. You know, the stars are aligning just for you. That's the manic side of the particular depression I suffer with. And that happens. God, I've completely lost where I was going with that. It's the contradiction of that. When it's all going right, and you think it's all ordained just for you personally, is that the thought often crosses my mind, I wish I was sad again. You know, I wanted to get well. I've wanted to get well for a long, long time, and I've worked very, very hard, practically, emotionally, and spiritually to do so. But there is that little bit, that little depressive, you know, it's the little, like, the black dog, the little puppy just crawling and chewing away inside of the critical voice saying, wouldn't it be nice to be sad again? Wouldn't it be great? Like, isn't it more interesting? Don't you have, you won't be able to, it's almost like you want to dine out on this tragedy forever and ever and ever and keep it going just because you feel like it makes you, you know, this romantic figure of tragedy or something. And it's absolutely ridiculous. And that is depression. That thing that does that is the depression. But the anxiety thing, I mean, to give an example, before I started rehearsing songs earlier, I'd been watching videos by Richard Dawson and Nev Clay and people like this, and they're the best. They're just clearly the best at what they do in the northeast of England, and they're the people who I've always wanted to. I consider them. I mean, Richard, I don't know very well. We've hung out a little bit at Kath and Phil's, Phil Tyler's, who I mentioned before. I'm really name dropping here, and I'm cringing. But what I'm trying to say is that Neville would definitely class as a friend. But I still felt quite, you know, that jealousy when I watched him, which makes me uncomfortable because, like I say, he's somebody I'd class as a friend, and it's very odd and quite creepy to have feelings like that, I guess, about somebody you would call a friend, and it's. There's guilt there too, and it made me feel anxious, very anxious that I was being that guy. And then on a base level, it made me feel anxious because of how good he was. Like, am I any good? Like, am I that good? You know, and that goes into the comparing yourself to people leaves you a bitter, insecure person, which I've been for a long, long time. I'm constantly doing that, comparing myself down to the shoes somebody might be wearing. You know, making judgments. Putting myself up against them, even in such a superficial realm as clothing. You know, I might be walking through town just trying to quietly judging everyone and then going, oh God, you know, he or she looks great and I look like shit, or God, that haircut's really nice. And it's I know it's preposterous, it's not the world I want to inhabit at all, but it's the one I find myself in, whether I want to or not, a lot of the time. And that's a lot of my own doing. And the anxiety tells me that, you know, you become aware that you have the power to manage these things. But then, similarly, by the same token, a lot of your anxiety and misery comes from yourself and how you respond to things. And like I say, my depression dictates a lot of the time that I respond to things in a very personal, kind of aggrieved nature. And that could be anything. I will take offence to so much, you know, personally, that... And then I have to say, well, I have to get perspective, get that fairer appraisal of things. And the fair appraisal goes back to criticism of yourself. You know, in the absence of the assuring voice of a mother, I cultivated, I guess, what is called in these circles of psychology is the critical voice. Which is basically just this guy, an ever-present, it's an omnipresent, I guess, voice in my head, the wall within my head, I would say, that is constantly saying, you know, you're shit, you're no good, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. And as in the case I mentioned in the earlier episode of Stephen King holding himself up to these great people who he considers better than he, I'm doing that all the time. I'm setting these ridiculously high standards. I remember saying to a therapist with me writing that, and sometimes just get so anxious that I'm no good because I'm actually benchmarking it against Oscar Wilde. And now her counter to that is, well, that's, you know, that ensures a very high standard. At least, you know, at least you're there's two sides to that you need to see. You don't need to always be on the darkness side, which says, you arrogant fucking idiot, like, what are you doing? But the other side is, well, there's nothing wrong with having high standards, and if you don't meet them, then that, so what? You're talking about Oscar Wilde, for Christ's sake. So it's finding that's the fairer appraisal, rather than just saying, oh, I did nothing today, I didn't do a podcast. I would sit down tonight with sort of like, almost like a journal entry and list the things I have, you know, what have I done? Well, I've just come off another long shift at work, and I've spent time today with a loved one, and I've been to an important appointment, and I've been, because I will be going to see a good friend. You know, these are all the things I have done. It's not all that I haven't done this thing. What about the things you have achieved? And it's not necessarily all about that, is it? Life, there's an episode of Mad Men where this beatnik guy says to Don Draper in a kind of hep bar, you know, yeah, because life's all about what you do, isn't it? And that really kind of says it all. I have this bizarre drive to do things all the time, and it's an anxiety. And then Billy Connolly, I was watching him last night on the South Bank show with Walt Meldon, and he was explaining his drive kind of comes from the humiliation he suffered at the hands of his aunt, or his aunt. It's funny how drive can come out of these things, out and out of an anxiety, or a means of, I need to figure out how I can show that I am worthwhile. And it can lead us down many interesting roads, some very creative, enriching roads, but sometimes not so much. But just with anxiety, it's all about keeping that appraisal fair. Keep it balanced. Find that balance and just, you know, allow the light to win. Okay, I'm going to wrap up there. I think I could probably go on a lot more about anxiety. I really don't feel like I've hit enough there at all. So maybe I'll do a part 3. Not right now, because I want to go and eat something. Because I'm a grown lad. But yeah, it feels good to have done that. Like I say, you can subscribe to the podcast now through the Apple Store. So you can get through iTunes. I've been approved, thanks to all the hard work of Roy Brown. And to me, let's be fair. Let's give a fair appraisal of myself. I'm doing the podcast. But Roy's done a lot for me. Thank you, Roy. He helps keep the black dog at bay, as do a lot of my friends. And you've just got to keep chasing the witch down. Make sure it stays away from your door. Just hang a, don't know, paint your door red. Tell it to fuck off. Do what you can. Do what you have to. Whatever gets you through. Look out for part 3. Subscribe. Look for Mark James Hammond, the Intelligentleman. If you go on my website, markjameshammond.com, you'll find a lot of stuff there. A lot of cool things. I've just done a live video stream. I'm sure you'll be able to view that. It's just me rehearsing some songs in my sitting room. It's really scrappy and messy, but it's real, it's truth. It's not, I'm not disguised or hiding behind anything. So, whether it's good or bad, just enjoy it. I'm playing the Nerd Hutch in Newcastle on the 2nd of November with Harry Reeve and Catherine Phil Taylor, which is a complete honour for me. That is the downstairs, it's the basement of Travelling Man, the comic book store. Please come along. What else am I doing? I'm going to try and get some physical releases of the album The Dead Sea Tapes, which is at markjameshammond.bandcamp.com. Getting some really lovely feedback about the album. I'm really proud of it, super duper proud of it. Want to get some physical copies done on cassette and disc, maybe even some other things. But I'll keep you updated on where they'll be available from. But if you go to the Bandcamp from this moment, you can download it, have a listen. And you'll find some of what I discuss in here condensed into song form. So it's not only insightful, erudite ramblings, it's set to a beautiful melody as well. So more bang for your buck there. And check out Stephen King's memoirs on writing. If you know, the podcast is also about the writing process, being that that's what I'm studying, advanced creative writing. That's my tip for the week. And have a look for Strunk's The Elements of Style, which King
Swears By, which I've just ordered in and picked up from Waterstones, which I'm about to get into. If you are interested in writing and an aspiring writer, and you are an aspiring writer, I can write that easily, I can't say it, then you do well to pick those two books up and give them a little shimmy shimmy. I'm off now to go and do something fun, try and switch off and not be too anxious about not doing things that are, you know, in inverted commas, productive. It's all right to switch off sometimes, and you can do that for as long as you want. There's all the time in the world, don't worry. In the meantime, just stay sexy, right? That's an order. All right, good night and good luck.